This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. This month marks the 30th anniversary of the premiere of NBC's The Cosby Show. The Cosby Show introduced America to the Huxtables, an upper-middle-class African-American family from Brooklyn. During its 8 seasons on television, The Cosby Show consistently ranked as one of the country's most watched TV shows. So to commemorate the anniversary, the Center for Arts, Digital Culture, and Entrepreneurship is hosting a roundtable discussion September 18th. It's called The Cosby Show at 30, Reflections on Race, Parenting, Inequality, and Education. Two of the panelists from that discussion are with us now. Duke Professor of African and African American Studies, Mark Anthony Neal. Welcome back, Mark.
How you doing, Frank? Good to see you.
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you. And Department Chair from the Department of Film and Interactive Media at St. Augustine's University, Natalie Bullock Brown. Natalie, welcome. Good to have you here as well.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
Mark, you wrote an essay a while back on the on sort of how your thoughts about The Cosby Show changed over time from a senior in college, I guess, when you were a little bit ambivalent about the program.
Yeah, you know, I was a young radical, you know, in the 80s. And The Cosby Show, you know, in many ways spoke to everything that I thought I wasn't invested in. And, you know, that's changed over the years. I mean, parenting has been one of the big reasons why it's changed. I think looking back at The Cosby Show, one of the things that resonates to me is the fact that a real significant portion of the show had to deal with different parenting strategies. And as I became a parent, I began to appreciate some of the nuances that Bill Cosby and his team of writers brought to that conversation on television.
But they weren't just any parents, Natalie. This was an upper-middle-class African-American family. How important is it, do you think, that they were an upper-middle-class family? Two professionals, a doctor and a lawyer, ran the household.
Right. I mean, I think it's very important because at the time that The Cosby Show first premiered, the types of images of African-Americans that were prevalent in television, you know, did not reflect any sort of upper middle class status. So I think that it was very significant. And I think, I mean, I think about how old I was when it first came on. And I think I was in eighth grade or ninth grade, but I went to a predominantly white school. And I just remember, you know, when it first came out, coming to school and everybody was excited about the show. And we were all talking about how cute Rudy was and how much we loved what Lisa Bonet had on. And, you know, we were completely engaged. And I think for someone like me who grew up sort of, you know, lower middle class, single mom, you know, but at this predominantly white, very rich private school, you know, the Huxtables reflected what I aspired to become. And so, but also in many ways, I felt like Lisa Bonet could be my girlfriend. You know, she could be my best friend. So I could relate to them, but then they also were, you know, on a level that was beyond, I think, where I saw myself. But so it was very interesting.
It holds a complicated place, though, doesn't it? I mean, there are these aspirations. It does bring an upper middle class black family to the attention of white Americans who may never have thought about it, on the one hand. On the other hand, it plays into a lot of stereotypes and perhaps aspiration on the part of Americans that we're past all of this now. See, here's what you can do if you just work hard and stick to the books, which could play against, especially for a young radical like you when you first saw the program.
I mean, The Cosby Show clearly carried the water for a lot of issues, right? And Bill Cosby wanted that. I mean, he was very public about the fact that when he looked at the images, particularly of African-American men on television, right, you had the example of Fred Sanford, who was a junk dealer. You had John Amos, you know, on Good Times, who never had a job. And he clearly was trying to intervene in that conversation in a certain kind of way. You know, when he initially imagined the show, it was going to be much more of a working class family. But he chose, you know, as some revision, of course, he's bringing in expertise from, you know, the African-American psychologist, Alvin Poussant, and he himself, you know, has a doctorate from Temple. So he's bringing all of this scholarship, a lot of it having to do with African-American pathology, you know, to bear on the production of this image of an African-American family. The irony of The Cosby Show throughout its run is that, you know, it's popular in everybody's household. And it becomes almost evidence that, you know, whatever social engineering had occurred around the civil rights movement you know, the Cosbys embodied the most successful aspects of that, right? And the irony is that while all this is playing out, you know, this is the beginning of the second term of the Reagan presidency. and here you have an administration that is actively dismantling many of the kind of civil rights gains that would have allowed for the creation of a Huxtable family.
Well, and then again, you can point to that. You point to the Huxtables and say, see, they've made it. Reagan's right. Let's just keep moving on our merry way, right? So, I guess the complicated place they hold, again, is an upper middle class family. The criticism at the time was that it was not overtly political, Natalie. But again, right. Bill Cosby hired a psychologist. He was. Do you think it was not political? Bill Cosby will say there is a political consciousness in this program. It's just maybe not what you want to see.
I think that the politics that were inserted in the Cosby Show were they were subtle, and I think that was for a reason. I don't think that the Cosby Show would have been nearly as successful as it was if Cosby had basically beat the viewers over the head with the issues of the day. But I think that he did. I think in presenting black culture and I think there was a episode where Theo had he had some emblem of the anti-apartheid movement on his door. The older daughter, was it Sandra? She names her kids Nelson and Winnie. Right. I mean, right. Things like that right. are reflections of that insertion of, you know, just some sort of hat tip to the fact that, you know, we need to pay attention to these issues. And I have, as you know, Cosby himself had a position, but he was not going to be overt with how he expressed that.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's so important about looking at the Cosby Show is that, you know, there's a tendency to think about that the Huxtables as kind of a black family whitewashed. But the number of times that, you know, characters show up with T-shirts or sweatshirts from historically black colleges and universities, you know, obscure paintings on the wall that art historians could, you know, you say, oh, that's an African-American painter there. The number of times that he brings in these kind of musical icons, you know, from Miriam Makeba to B.B. King to Sammy Davis, you know, it clearly celebrated, you know, at least in Cosby's view, the best of black culture without having to deal openly with some of the pathology that he might have viewed within black communities.
And we do have a clip. This was from the Cosby Show when the Huxtables, I think they're celebrating his parents' 49th anniversary. And we hear that the nighttime is the right time by Ray Charles.
No, the two of you sit down there. Now, we have put together a little form of entertainment for you. We have the record here, and we're going to perform for you. We figure after 49 years of marriage, perhaps the two of you need a little romantic inspiration. Okay, now here we go.
So what's going on here? What's happening on the screen right now?
We have the kids and the family coming down the stairs, performing this song, and it becomes this wonderful multi-generational moment, right? You're talking about the grandparents and the parents and the kids sharing a musical text that at this point in time is 40 years in past, you know, on some level talking about the classic nature, not just of Ray Charles, but the music that he embodied, you know, in that context. And the family was still invested in that. I mean, Cosby did that throughout the series. There's this wonderful moment where he and Claire, it's late in the evening, about to go to bed, and he puts on Big Maybelle's Candy, you know, which is this really kind of bluesy. And I had never heard the song before, right? And I remember the next day after the episode going to Tower Records in New York and trying to track down who Big Maybelle was. And there were these little gems that he put in the context of the series all the time.
But as you said, the important thing, too, is not just the education that we might get. We might all decide to look that up because we like the music. But the fact that there were a multi-generational, everybody's participating, allows us to see, oh, wait, everybody knows this song. Everybody in that family has heard this song. They know the moves to this song, right?
And I think that's what really resonated with me. This is one of my that's one of my favorite episodes, actually, because the fact that, you know, Rudy can come in and sing the, you know, that part and just really be into it. To me, that spoke to, you know, the type of family that the Huxtables mm-hmm. were. And I think for many of us, and again, you know, I was raised by essentially a single mom. I mean, my dad was involved. But the point is that, you know, that type of intermingling was not happening in my household. So there was something really, I think, magical about that moment. It is intergenerational, but it also speaks to the type of interaction that the parents have with the kids and that cultural transaction of, you know, this is who we are and we want to make sure that you know about this aspect of your culture. I think that was, you know, that was brilliant. And again, it was not overstated. It was implicit. And I think that it just was amazing.
What kind of themes, too? We've got another clip here that I want to play from The Cosby Show. I think this is from actually the first episode where you've got Bill Cosby talking to his son about, you know, slacking, and he wants him to pay a little more attention to his books. Let's listen to the clip.
Dad, I thought about what you said, and I see your point.
Thank you. Thank you.
But I have a point, too.
Make your point.
You're a doctor and mom's a lawyer, and you're both successful and everything, and that's great. But maybe I was born to be a regular person and have a regular life. If you weren't a doctor, I wouldn't love you less because you're my dad. And so instead of acting disappointed because I'm not like you, maybe you can just accept who I am and love me anyway. Because I'm your son.
Theo, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. No wonder you get D's and everything. Now, you are afraid to try because you're afraid that your brain is going to explode and it's going to ooze out of your ears. Now, I'm telling you, you are going to try as hard as you can. And you're going to do it because I said so. I am your father. I brought you in this world, and I'll take you out.
That's kind of an amazing moment in television history.
It's an important thing because what Cosby here is doing is playing with the conventions of the sitcom at the time and then disrupting them. Mm. So everyone was prepared for Theo to make his great statement and the crowd claps and everybody feels good and the two of them hug and the episode is over. And Bill Cosby just goes, no, that's not what's going to happen. Right? Yeah. And it's a disruption in particular that introduces white America to black parenting. And what's critical about this moment, and Natalie mentioned this earlier, right? You're talking about a moment where black culture is so clearly aspirational. And The Cosby Show was about this aspirational view. But there's no aspiration without expectation, yeah. Right? And what Cosby is saying to Theo, regardless of what you think and who we are, we're going to continue to hold you to higher expectations, even if the school system's not going to do that, even if your peer group's not going to do that, we're going to hold you to some level of expectation. And it was just a brilliant move. I mean, so much of that first season is drawn from Bill Cosby's stand-up, Bill Cosby himself, you know, the film in 1982. So some of these things may have resonated with folks, but, you know, what he does there is just – like you mentioned, one of the most important things that we've saw in television in the 1980s.
And very complicated, too, because, again, as a white audience, you can perceive, you see that one way, and as a black audience, you might see it as another. I mean, I can imagine a middle-class white audience saying, yeah, that's what we should see more of that kind of thing. If they do that, you know, you can kind of hear that in some living rooms across the country, which is maybe not what he was going for. And so it's a complicated message, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I was thinking as Mark was talking that, you know, now that I am a parent, yeah. I mean, I would have a similar conversation right. with my right. son, who is probably the same age that Theo was in that clip. But the sort of insidious message underneath that is that, yes, you have to do is work hard. And it's that pull yourself up mm-hmm. by your bootstraps yes, right. message that, as Mark said, you know, at that time, right. that was the beginning of that pull yourself up by your bootstraps really becoming something that you could not right. aspire to. It was not going to work. And especially now, we know that there is a permanent lower impoverished class, I'll call it, that is just not going to be able to. I don't know how, it doesn't matter how many jobs you work. It doesn't matter, you know, how much you save. There is just not the opportunity that's going to allow you to transcend where you presently find right. yourself. And so it's a mixed message. And unfortunately, in many ways, it's kind of a dangerous one, especially coming from Cosby. I mean, think about some of the things he said in recent times and how very conservative he has become.
We're talking about the legacy of The Cosby Show today on The State of Things. Mark Anthony Neal is here from Duke. Natalie Bullock Brown is here from St. Augustine's. And to talk more about that, because, you know, it is not the Huxtables. The program is called The Cosby Show because Bill Cosby was already probably the lead entertainer in America. And maybe he still is today. Does that show succeed? Is there a show without Bill Cosby?
I don't think so. I think he was the particular figure that would draw audiences to, you know, he was the crossover star. You know, that couldn't have been the Richard Pryor show.
Right.
You know, that couldn't have been the Red Fox, even though right. Red Fox had done that already. But it couldn't have been not in that kind of family construction. It couldn't have been the Red Fox show. Right. Cosby had a certain kind of appeal to mainstream America. I mean, he didn't start selling Jell-O pudding pops after the Cosby show. You know, he was already doing that kind of work and had long crafted this kind of crossover non-offensive personality, whether it was in his stand-up or in I Spy and you know, the Fat Albert and the Cosby Kids, you know, which is also the space where he delved into black pathology, mm-hmm. you know, on Saturday mornings. And so I think he's the only figure that really could have pulled it off to the extent that he did.
Well, non-offensive and mutually offensive. I mean, I think that's the thing about maybe that made it an almost kind of literary genius in the way that it was presented. Is it benign or is everybody sort of under the microscope and under attack in this program?
That's an interesting question. I'd like to bring in a comment that an older friend of mine who's African American, maybe 20 years older than I am, shared with me recently, which is that, you know, in the midst of all of the accolades and all the excitement about the Cosby Show, he shared with me that he and people that he grew up with were not excited. In fact, they were put off by the Cosby Show because they felt like they grew up in the projects. And so they felt like, you know, I could never date Lisa Bonet.
Right.
Cosby
no.
would never,
right.
Huxtable right. would right. never allow me in his
that's
house.
That's
right.
Great.
And so, you know, I thought that was really deep because it never occurred to me that there was a segment of the black viewing audience right. that would reject the Cosby Show because in their world, you know, this is not I don't have any access to this.
Yeah. And, you know, I think what's important there is that Cosby was also sensitive. He heard those critiques and he was sensitive to it. And so in some ways, when he launches A Different World with Lisa Bonet, you know, A Different World is the Eric Holder to the Cosby Show's Barack Obama. And so A Different World actually gets into those social issues, gets into black sociopolitical yeah. issues in ways that the Cosby Show doesn't touch. And in fact, it doesn't do that until Lisa Bonet's actually moved out of the mix. You know, and Debbie Allen takes over, you know, directing the show and kind of crafting it and framing it. So he was very sensitive to those critiques, but he did not want that brand,
right,
to be associated with that. He created another brand that could kind of carry the water for those kinds of issues.
Right. And it never, A Different World never had the type of success.
Crossover success. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
right.
And we don't have enough time, but I guess no program ever will, given now the kind of niche, siloed way that we pay attention to media today. So that may have been the last of the great crossover and sort of grand American programs in some way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Great conversation. Thanks very much. We've been talking about The Cosby Show today. Duke African and African American Studies Professor Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank, as always.
And the chair of the Film and Interactive Media Department at St. Augustine's University, Natalie Bullock Brown. Natalie, thank you.
Thank you very much.
The Center for Arts, Digital Culture, and Entrepreneurship is hosting a roundtable discussion, The Cosby Show at 30, Reflections on Race, Parenting, Inequality, and Education. It'll be Thursday, September 18th, 7 o'clock, the John Hope Franklin Center. And if you missed all that, go to our website, stateofthings.org. We've got it there. Just ahead, a new perspective on the origins of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Stay tuned.
bestseller